On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to a pre-Snowmageddon edition of Maryland Morning. The Maryland General Assembly is 10 days deep into this year's session. WIPR's Annapolis reporter Rachel Bay and senior news analyst Fraser Smith join me to recap some of the early action, including efforts to overturn a veto on voting rights for felons. Then Mark Hyman drops in to talk about the big money the Orioles have thrown at first baseman Chris Davis, the big splash in the Big Ten made by the University of Maryland men's basketball team, the big game in its 50th year, and a big loss for the city of St. Louis. Plus, students from Wide Angle Youth Media explore food deserts in Baltimore, and more shoppers are looking to update their wardrobe in consignment stores. Fashionista Zoe Washington Chef shares some tips for finding treasures in the resale racks. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan Sterner has the local headlines. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Nathan, before we start talking about the Maryland General Assembly, we're going to get a little update on the first 10 days of that August compilation. Let's make sure we emphasize to folks that this snowstorm is the real deal. This is not one of those instances where, you know, dire things are predicted, but then somehow it veers off to the left or veers off to the right. I listened in on a press conference yesterday from the National Weather Service, Louis Uccellini, who's the head of the National Weather Service, and he talked about how there's modeled consistency.
Yeah, model consistency. Basically, they are almost completely certain that this storm is going to do what they're saying it's going to do, and they've been saying it for several days now. Earlier this week, the area was under a blizzard watch. Watch means it might come. Warning means it will come. But the National Weather Service practically never issues a blizzard watch because they never know that far in advance that a major storm is going to hit. They've known this for days, and in issuing the blizzard warning yesterday at noon, they pretty much cemented it in. As I mentioned a moment ago, they're changing the timeline. They think it's going to get here a little bit later than they had originally thought, but they are pretty sure it's going to get here, and they are pretty sure it's going to drop 2 feet or more of snow on Baltimore City.
Yeah, they're talking about maybe a foot by the time we wake up tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, and then another foot by the time we wake up on Sunday morning.
It all depends on how much sleet comes down, because it's going to mix with sleet off and on tonight and tomorrow. There's even a possibility of thundersnow, the thunderstorms while the snow is falling sometime after midnight tonight, and wind gusts 55 to 60 miles an hour during the storm make it all the more treacherous.
Yeah, it's going to be really a serious storm. 50 million people affected potentially in, up and down the East Coast. 2 to even 3 feet of snow in the near Washington. So who knows? But, you know, and again, as to when it starts, about a half hour ago, they started saying perhaps it's moving a little faster than they thought it was.
It's moving a little slower than they thought it was yesterday. I'd get here a little in the evening rather than the afternoon.
You know, so, you know, maybe sometime between 3 and 7. That's the window they're giving us.
Watch the skies, and once the snow starts to fly, stay off the roads.
Stay off the roads, absolutely. And stay tuned to WIPR and Nathan Sterner and Matt Tacka and the rest of the gang here who will keep everybody up to date. All right, so let's get up to date on the 436th session of the Maryland General Assembly, which began about a week and a half ago. This morning, that update will come from Rachel Bay, who's WIPR's Annapolis reporter. Morning, Rachel. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And joining me along with Rachel is WIPR senior news analyst and columnist for the Daily Record, Fraser Smith. Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Morning, Tom.
So, Rachel, the session started with some overrides of vetoes that Governor Hogan had signed last session. Mike Bush promised that perhaps as many as 6 of them would in fact be overridden, and they've done a pretty good job so far. They haven't gotten quite through the whole list, but what have they done? What have they accomplished to date?
So yesterday they overrode the vetoes of 5 bills. They decriminalized the possession of marijuana paraphernalia. They created protections from basically the government seizing your assets. They required that online booking websites for pay hotel taxes when they rent hotel rooms. Those were a few of the items. And the last one, the sixth bill, the Senate is expected to take up on, the House is already over in the veto, and the Senate is expected to take that up on February 5th.
And that has to do with when felons are allowed to vote. We'll talk about that in a second, but some of these things are kind of just administrative in a way, like the marijuana paraphernalia. They decriminalized marijuana or possession of small amounts of marijuana a couple of years ago, but then they found that it was still criminal to possess rolling papers or, you know, a pipe or something like that. So I guess they took care of that, what they thought was a loophole in that law, right?
Yeah, the supporters of that law were basically, they were calling this basically a fix, an amendment of sorts to the law that was passed a couple of years ago. There was a funny comment on the House floor yesterday where someone likened it to legalizing eating crabs, but not Old Bay. So it would be illegal to eat the Old Bay. You know, they were saying that if you could only face a civil penalty for possession of up to 10 grams of marijuana, but if you had the rolling paper or another device used to consume the marijuana, then you could face criminal penalties.
Right. And then there's this civil asset forfeiture bill. These are all very confusing things, but basically it holds the government to a higher burden of proof when you've committed some sort of civil crime, and it prevents assets from being seized at a particular point in the process.
Right. It basically requires, so under current law, if the government suspects you of having committed some sort of crime, they can civilly seize your assets before you've actually been convicted of a crime or even charged of a crime. So this bill is meant to address that. And there's actually a new bill that's been introduced this session to kind of piggyback off of this old one to take it a step further and further enhance those protections.
And Fraser Smith, what does it mean that, you know, a week ago Wednesday, Governor Hogan said, you know my phone number, just pick up the phone, give me a call, let's work together. It was all the sweetness and nice. Right out of the gate, the legislature is saying, okay, this is what you did last year. We're getting rid of that.
Well, it'll be surprising to no one that sometimes they don't achieve perfection in the bill drafting and what they vote on. So it is really pretty much housekeeping, except I think for the issue of felons voting and when they can vote.
Right. So the House has voted to override that veto. The Senate has delayed a vote on that because they want to do some other things first. And the governor is dead set against this.
Well, it's interesting, I think, because there is a movement in the country to change thinking and policy about ex-felons and current felons, reducing the size of prisons. And guess why? Because it's quite expensive. But others are saying if you really want to bring people back into the community, you need to make them a full partner. And if people can't vote, then they're really not back.
Right.
So people are saying, let's try to smooth it out, make it a little more easier and a little faster.
Right. So it's going to be a little, it accelerates the process by which a felon can regain his or her voting rights. When the Senate takes this up, it looks like they're going to take it up the 5th of February, so, you know, a week or so from now. What are the chances of it passing through the Senate? The governor really has said this is bad law and bad policy. Does he have a lot of people who agree with him on that?
So it looks like it's going to be a tight vote in the Senate. Actually, the Senate President Mike Miller postponed this, and when he did, he said that the reason for postponing it was that there's an empty seat right now in the Senate that's going to be filled by a Democrat, and it looks like he said he was holding out for that seat to be filled to make sure he has one extra vote.
Yeah, so that is an indication that he thinks this is pretty tight, pretty close. Well, we'll keep an eye on that to be sure. Fraser, the governor is hugely popular. He's got something like a 67% approval rating. I mean, that's just gigantic. It's got to be one of the highest approval ratings of any sitting governor in the United States.
I don't know what the numbers are across the country, Tom, but, you know, given how much mistrust there is in politicians in general, it's even more interesting to me that he's as high as he is in the rankings.
And it's really, I think everybody applauds him and is inspired by the way he handled his diagnosis and treatment for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Everybody's very delighted that he seems to be in recovery and in remission. But that didn't hurt politically, did it?
Not at all. I've heard people refer to it as...
it hurt physically, but it didn't hurt politically.
He's having the advantage of surviving a cancer scare, which, as you say, everybody applauds and is very happy about. There's some other things that really, from the Baltimore point of view, argue against that. The Red Line cancellation, for example. But, you know, he has been making some moves to try to do some plus things for the city, dealing with vacant housing and demolishing sort of hopeless blocks in the city.
Yeah, Rich, let's talk about that. There's a question as to where that money, the $700 million, a part of which is going to be spent tearing down vacant properties, where that actually comes in the budget.
So there was actually something came out from the Department of Legislative Services, which analyzes the budget, basically saying that of that $700 million, about $75 million of it is in actually new funding. But it's not currently in the budget. It's something that is going to be financed over time and is expected to be released in a supplemental budget. That actually, the fact that it's not already in the budget has a lot of the Democratic leaders a little bit worried about where that money is going to come from, and is it going to be a bargaining chip moving forward?
Yeah, there's a bill to change the state motto. I didn't realize we had a motto, but it's the Italian motto of the Calvert family: "Fatti maschi parole femmine," manly words, womanly deeds. And this is on the state seal, Fraser, and it looks like it. Perhaps its days on the state seal may be numbered, huh?
I doubt it very much. I think that it's going to be on the seal for as long as we have a seal. I'm just guessing.
All right. And we're not talking about the seals in the zoo. We're talking about the state seal here, right? Be clear about that, all right? There's also, Rachel, a bill to talk about the state, changing the state song, right? You've got a couple of options there as we finish up. Tell us what those options are going to be.
Sure. So there's a couple of options in there, and it's not totally clear how that's going to pan out, but at least one of them changes the lyrics, but maintaining the song mostly as it is. And there's another alternative proposal to kind of throw out the song and start fresh. But there's a lot of people who are offended by the references to the Confederacy from the Civil War.
Right. Maryland, my Maryland. All right. Well, we will keep in touch with that, and we will have you come in and sing another tune for us pretty soon. Thanks so much, Rachel Bay, Fraser Smith. Rachel Bay is our eyes and ears in Annapolis. She covers the legislature for the WYPR news team. Fraser Smith is our institutional memory for all things political. He's our senior news analyst and columnist for the Daily Record. Coming up, we'll check in with sports guru Mark Hyman, and a little later in the broadcast, we'll hear a story about food deserts from the young reporters at Wide Angle Youth Media. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks again, Nathan. Good morning and welcome back, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's time now to talk some sports here on Maryland Morning. Our resident sports guy, Mark Hyman, joins me in Studio A. He is on the faculty of George Washington University and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Tom, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. So the Orioles spent a couple of bucks on their first baseman, recently. They have offered Chris Davis, they've signed a contract with Chris Davis for $161 million.
Why do you say it that way? Say it as if that's an outrageous figure.
Well, because it is an outrageous figure.
Really?
I mean, you know, that's $2 million more than I'm making here at WIPR, and I'm always a little bit upset when I hear somebody's, outpricing me. But, is this in keeping with sort of the industry standard at the moment?
Well, it's a lot of money, clearly. And, it's funny. Peter Angelos bought the team in 1993, paid $173 million for the entire team.
And now 161 for one player.
Yeah. But I think it's important to put this into some context. 25 years ago, the Orioles signed their best player at the time to a long-term contract. His name was Cal Ripken. They signed him for a contract that provided for $6.1 million per year, 25 years ago. Today, the Orioles are signing their best player for approximately $23 million a year, about 3 to 4 times what Cal was getting. Industry revenues in Major League Baseball, the revenues generated by the entire industry, are 3 to 4 times what they were 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So his contract is 3 to 4 times, but so is the revenue.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, but sometimes I think fans fail to consider the fact that baseball as an industry is much more profitable, is generating much more revenue than it was then. You know, fans, the revenue generation, the increase, is not really a function of what happens at the ballpark. You know, sure, ticket prices have gone up a little bit in the last 25 years. It costs you more for a beer and a hot dog. But the real growth in baseball revenues have come in the digital space.
Right.
There is now an MLB network, a television net, 24-hour television network devoted exclusively to baseball. There is an MLB.com website. Major League Baseball has developed a very lucrative digital company. They run the National Hockey League's website and also the National Hockey League's network.
It's run by Major League Baseball.
Yeah, they provide the digital support for the National Hockey League's network and website. And look, here's an app on my phone. It's an MLB app. I can get the radio broadcast, live radio broadcast of every major league game, any live game I can get. I can get both sides, both calls, both teams.
If you're a Cubs fan living in Fairbanks, Alaska, you can just press the app and hear the game.
Exactly. And I pay $18 a year for that, something like that. I think it's a great value. None of that existed in 1992 when Cal signed his
contract.
And
a big part of Mr. Davis's contract is deferred. What does that mean?
Yeah, $42 million of the total is deferred, meaning that he doesn't collect that portion of the contract until the contract is actually out. He'll probably be out of baseball when he's collecting a significant amount of that money. So in a sense, that portion of the contract is discounted because the cost of money is going to change over that period.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk about the NFL. First of all, kudos and high fives to them. Catherine Smith has been hired as the Buffalo Bills special teams quality control coach. I don't even know what that is, but I do know that she's the first woman to be hired by the National Football League in a coaching position, and that's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, sign of the times. And there is a woman who is an official in the NFL now. So I think that's all for the good.
So the ceiling has broken. Talk about this movie, Concussion. You have written about concussions in sports for children in particular. Your latest book is called Concussions in Our Kids. Concussions have become front and center as a subject of discussion in the NFL. And the movie itself, which I haven't seen, I assume you've seen it?
I have.
Yeah. Is it a good movie? And does it tell the story correctly? And what do you think the NFL thinks of it?
Yeah, the movie is really the story of a pathologist who was working in Pittsburgh at the time. His name is Bennett Amalu, a Nigerian pathologist, who was the pathologist who discovered CTE in a football player for the first time. It was known that boxers could get this degenerative brain disease as a result of the repetitive head trauma that they took, but it was not known that football players were vulnerable to this disease, and Dr. Amalu was the first to discover that.
That's the character that Will Smith plays.
the Will Smith character. I think the movie is extremely welcome in the sense that it's really raising awareness. And people who are not really familiar with the issue or weren't really interested in it, seeing it in this dramatic way, I think is very positive. It's a bit of a caricature. You know, it was kind of a cartoon in some ways because it's a very simple telling of the story, and there are lots of nuance that is missing from the story. But I thought it was a very entertaining movie, and I hope that people get engaged in the issue as a result.
There are some signs that the NFL is changing its tactics or changing its response to these, it seems every day you hear about another player, a former player, who's now, you know, suffering serious brain disease. What are those signs?
Well, there was a very disturbing study that was published probably 3 to 4 months ago that looked at former NFL players and tracked their history as youth players and made the following observation, that former NFL players who had played youth football and had been playing tackle football at a very young age were more vulnerable to degenerative brain issues, to memory issues, to impulse control issues as adults than NFL players who had not begun playing tackle football as very young children. That's important for parents to know.
Yeah, you have the President of the United States saying that if he'd had sons who wanted to play football, he probably wouldn't have let them play. I mean, that's pretty tough stuff. But is the NFL itself hopping on any part of that bandwagon as well? And when it comes to tackle football for kids in particular?
We're beginning to see a change in the NFL's attitude. For a long time, the NFL was a very strong advocate for tackle for kids. Kids as young as 5 years old are playing tackle football.
Pop Warner leagues and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, Pop Warner has a division for 5, 6, and 7 year olds, believe it or not. And for a long time, the NFL was totally supportive of that. And all of their efforts were going into teaching new tackling techniques that they said were safer, you know, and took the head out of tackling. And they spent an awful lot of money promoting that. Now, recently, and during the NFL playoff games last weekend, it seems that they're pivoting from that position and now speaking a lot more about a league that they started called NFL Flag, which is a flag football league. And as most parents know, flag, you know, involves no tackling. You're just pulling a flag. And that would be an enormously positive change, I think.
Yeah, and it sounds like they are going to then, you know, be adapting that and not so much dissuading kids from playing tackle football, but working to give them an alternative.
You know, the NFL has an amazing marketing capability. They've got a lot of money to spend on marketing, and they've got a very strong brand. So now they're marketing NFL Flag is, you know, you get an NFL jersey. They're presenting it in a way that I think is going to be appealing to kids. You know, most kids would rather play tackle than flag. But if the NFL gets behind this idea that flag is an acceptable, is a fun way to, you know, be a football player, I think that's going to be very powerful.
The folks in St. Louis not feeling very fun or funny about the NFL. Their team has deserted St. Louis to go back to L.A. What's that mean for the league? What's that mean for those two cities?
Well, I think the moral of this story is that sometimes it's helpful to be a billionaire. And the owner of the St. Louis, soon-to-be Los Angeles Rams, is Stan Kroenke, who is, according to Forbes magazine, is worth more than $7 billion. He owns the Denver Nuggets of the NBA and the Colorado Avalanche of the NHL. And he presented a plan to the NFL to build a $3 billion stadium in Inglewood, California, which is, basically LA, and it's going to be this incredible, incredible facility, and that was very persuasive to the NFL, and so Kroenke's going to contribute $1 million toward that $3 billion, and the NFL, of course, has approved this move, so St. Louis is losing a franchise. The Chargers and the Raiders, two other franchises that were interested in moving to L.A., they apparently won't be. It'll be the Rams.
All right. Before we take off here, I just want to give a shout-out to the men's and women's basketball teams at the University of Maryland. They're both 17-2. The men are third in the Big Ten. The women are first in the Big Ten. This program has really blown up. These guys are doing great, both sides.
The men and the women.
Yeah.
Men and the women.
Yeah.
One interesting, do we have time to talk about
we
one
have 10
interesting
seconds,
change?
Yep.
Okay. The women moved to 4 10-minute quarters this year in the NCAA. Big change intended to speed up the game, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's fun to watch both sides, both teams, men's and women. All right, Mark, appreciate it. We shall see you soon. Thanks.
Okay, Tom.
Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Now we turn to a team of young reporters and producers, all of whom are in middle school, who are enrolled in a program called Baltimore Speaks Out at the Herring Run branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. The program is one of several at various city library locations run by Wide Angle Youth Media. It's a nonprofit that teaches city youth how to tell their own stories and become engaged in their communities. We want to shine a spotlight on these creative young people and hear their stories. So here's a report that they've sent us about access to healthy food choices in different neighborhoods here in Baltimore.
I am in the Edmondson Shopping Center in front of the Herring Run Library. Trash is scattered on the ground and cars are whizzing by at a nearby intersection.
I see fast food restaurants. Looking down the street, I can see, I think, a McDonald's. And in the shopping center, I see a China Garden.
Bella Edison has historically been a diverse working class neighborhood, but has struggled since the recession. It is now mostly lower-income African-American community that has been identified as a food desert.
We decided to investigate why this community doesn't have lots of healthy food options.
We talked to Carla Evans, a local resident of Bella Edison, about what is available in her community.
Food options that we have is majority fast food. Sometimes you might can find, there's no farmer's market near here, so it's really not any healthy options. It's important to have healthier food choices because you're growing each day and we have to take care of our bodies with fitness and what we put into our bodies. The reason why I think some communities have more access to healthier food in Baltimore than other communities is based on the financial class that may reside in those areas.
Neighborhoods in other parts of the city are starting to see changes in their food landscapes. We spoke to Kimberly and Mark Cruz, residents in West Baltimore.
The options that we have in our neighborhood are available now because people are realizing that a lot of the communities around Baltimore City are food deserts, so they're incorporating fresh produce into areas such as farmers markets and produce giveaways so that people will have access to fresh produce.
I guess it's something the residents within the city need to clamor for so that those kind of stores and those kind of restaurants can understand that this is what the people want, because we all need to be healthier. So healthy food choices help you make better decisions.
We were surprised to learn that there are farms in Baltimore City. We're at the Real Food Farms, a short drive from the library in Clifton Park. The farm supports their local community by running food education programs and delivers fresh produce to nearby neighborhoods.
Outside is open land. I can hear crickets chirping, and I can hear car traffic in the distance.
Right now, we are sitting in a small garden with the farm manager of Real Food Farms, Miss Maisha Taylor.
There is farmland in Charm City. Recently, maybe in the last couple of years, a lot of vacant homes transitioned into vacant lots. So the city has created a program called Adopt a Lot, which allows city residents to adopt a lot to turn it into a park, you can turn it into a farm. We have urban farms in these communities now that are offering an alternative to like a grocery stores who don't offer fresh produce or, you know, fresh apples or even sustainable meat.
What do you grow on your farm?
On our farm, we grow diverse fruits and vegetables. So we have a fruit orchard of about 100 fruit trees, persimmons, apples, peaches. We pretty much cover the gamut of things you can grow besides citrus fruits.
Now we are more aware of resources available to Baltimore City residents, and we have a vision for growing green spaces.
In order to make the community healthier, I would say we could move some of the restaurants like move them to like a different area and make like farmers markets where people could go to get healthy vegetables for their kids, so they're at least growing up knowing what is good for them to eat.
I think that in order for the Bella Edison community to have better food choices, the people can go down to town hall and demand policymakers to give us access to healthier food at grocery stores, corner stores, and to have more farmers markets.
My hopes for a healthier Baltimore is like have more farm areas, tear down any buildings that aren't used, and like put a greenhouse there or a garden area where people can come in and plant whatever they want to.
Bella Edison is an example of a neighborhood that could benefit from a farmer's market or programs like Adopt a Lot and Rural Food Farms. We hope that policymakers and community members will continue improving access to healthy food for neighborhoods like Bella Edison.
If everyone works together to have better food choices, it can be a healthier community.
Thanks to the students from the Wide Angle Youth Media Program called Baltimore Speaks Out. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You know, if you're looking to update your wardrobe this season, you might head for the mall or wait for a sale or go online, but a lot of smart shoppers are taking advantage of resale or consignment stores. It's one of the hottest trends in fashion these days. Whether online through places like Etsy or eBay, or in a place down the block, resale stores can be treasure troves of great fashion for the person with the right eye and a little bit of time. Zoe Washington Chef is our fashion guru. She's a fashion editor and creative consultant for Essence, Elle, and other leading magazines, and the founder of Little Bird, a fashion consulting company focusing on the teen market. Good to see you, Zoe. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. So this resale thing is a thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's a thing. It's a sleeping giant right now in the luxury market, but also just in the retail market.
I mean, and the selection that's available out there is amazingly good.
Yes. I think when people say consignment or resale, people immediately turn to this idea of, okay, dusty bins and sort of old vintage shops and everything's kind of gross. But what's going on is that the industry is really hip to the game. They know that there's people who have elevated tastes and elevated needs. And so what they're doing is they're coming back with smaller, more boutique style designer consignment stores, brick and mortar, or shops online, which is really popular.
That's amazing that it's online. I mean, just the whole, this niche, though, I mean, people have really discovered this. First Research, a firm that does this kind of research, estimates that the resale industry in the United States is about $16 billion.
Oh, yeah.
Goodwill. Everybody donates stuff to Goodwill, and some folks go there. I mean, my daughter put herself through college shopping at Goodwill.
You know,
10 cents for a shirt and stuff. They did $5.1 billion in retail sales at Goodwill. So this is all through the spectrum, from the low end to the high end.
To the high end. And so what you're seeing is that people are going into Goodwill, and it in the face of the customers changing as well. So where it used to be, okay, people would think that these were more charitable organizations, it's becoming a destination because people know that they want a deal and they want to be able to shop at their own leisure and choose from a bunch of different designers, and whether that's contemporary basic or low-end designers, they want to be able to do that at an affordable price. And what's really happening is that companies are coming out online. So you have like Tradesy, for example, or The RealReal, Reese, that are creating this luxury experience, something that is similar to Net-a-Porter or Yuke's or even a traditional model like Bloomingdale's.com. They're taking that experience and applying it to the consignment space. So the customer is going on and maybe you have the instant trust because you know that the pieces have been authenticated and they have this level of curation about them. It feels like someone has come and like a buyer for a major department store has sifted through all the mess. So you don't feel like you're shopping at a grimy consignment store, quote unquote. You're shopping in a very elevated experience, much like any kind of department store.
So if you're online and you see this, you know, Donna Karan dress or something, the credibility of that site hinges on the site saying, yeah, this really is a Donna Karan. It's not a knockoff.
Completely. It's all about the authentication process. So, for example, with The RealReal, when it launched in New York, they had people come to you and actually visit the garment and look at it, see the condition, A, and B, authenticate it. Make sure that this was actually by the designer that it says it is. It isn't some cheap Chinatown knockoff, those types of elements. So, and they sell brands like Chanel, where the authentication is very intense and that is and it's necessary because it has to justify the still $1,200 to $1,500 price tag on a designer, you know, resale piece. Mm-hmm. And then on
but that's as opposed to how many thousands
exactly.
It would be if you bought it in a store or whatever.
Exactly. And I think when it first came out, people thought, oh, this is going to influence the way, this is going to take a bite out of luxury retail. But it actually doesn't. And it doesn't in this way because people will justify now buying a $3,500 Chanel bag because, you know, when people say it's an investment, that could just be words like, oh, yes, it's a great investment piece. Labels like Chanel, Celine, vintage Dior, they appreciate with time. So a Chanel bag, for example, that you might have bought in the 80s for $800 or $1,000 right now could very well be worth $3,400.
And that's what you'd pay for it now
at a consignment
shop. And that's what you'd pay for
it now at a consignment site.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily a bargain place. I mean, in terms of, you know, you're going to find stuff cheap.
No, you're not necessarily going to find stuff cheap. You'll still find it for a fraction of the price that you would pay in a traditional retail model. But what you're finding is, okay, this is an item that's either rare or something that is a hot item. So even H&M collaborations, designer collaborations, go on sale on these designer resale sites, and it's more expensive than if you just actually gone to H&M at the time. But you're not necessarily getting a deal all the time, but you are getting something amazing, and it'll be, quote, one of a kind because mm-hmm. you won't see tons of people wearing the exact same thing.
Yeah, so it's certainly unique. Mm-hmm. The brick-and-mortar consignment places.
Yes.
You walk into these places, and, you know, my wife and daughter are big aficionados of these places, and they see these designer clothes with the labels still on, with the tags still on them. So are you suspect when you see that?
Because the circumstances,
Lord knows what they are.
Right? Oh, no, that shows you, that actually reflects upon our sort of consumer culture. I think within the last 10 years, there was a huge amount of people who were buying things at Bloomingdale's, Neiman Marcus, in mass quantities and not really using them. And I think for a while, people thought the more clothes I have, the more stylish I am. But that's changed. Now people are realizing, okay, well, I should invest in a few pieces, and then I'll supplement that with fast fashion like Zara and H&M and Forever 21. And then when I revisit my closet in 3 years and realize I never wore that, you know, Calvin Klein runway dress, I'm taking it to a consignment store, and I get premium cost because it has the tag still on it. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you're somebody who wears clothes with a tag still on it.
Which I've done by mistake.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the tag says Target.
Exactly.
But when they're consignment, that means that the person who gives the garment gets part of the sale price, right? Is that?
Yes.
That hasn't changed.
That
right?
hasn't changed. And, you know, there's designer consignment, then there's just designer resale where maybe, you know, in New York, there's some great boutiques where you just go and they give you a certain amount of money right off the bat for what you give them. Very much like a Plato's Closet type of model, which is also a huge company. Plato's Closet on the lower end will resell Abercrombie & Fitch, Hollister, you know, Gap, Old Navy, items that you typically don't even expect to be expensive in the first place, but they do it for a different market, the teen market that is a lot more fickle and that maybe might not want to go to H&M or Forever 21 all the time.
And I would imagine that the rise of the consignment and the resale market is expanding the market for fashion, right? Because there's a bunch of people who certainly weren't going to fool with it when it was, you know, full retail price, but now they're getting hip to this.
Completely. And I think it's changing the way that people view luxury. So, you know, if I'm going on, you know, Chanel's website, or if I'm going on Neiman Marcus and I see something that's really amazing, I might try to follow it and see if it goes on sale. And if it doesn't go on sale to my liking, I might abandon it and then revisit it on a luxury resale site and see if somebody bought it, didn't like it, and wasn't able to return it that later that season or the next season, and I can get it for a fraction of the cost. You know, and there's some great brick and mortar stores even here in Baltimore, like Redo in Roland Park is one of my favorite stores, because you go in and again, you get this personal feeling like it has been curated and edited like any other classic boutique.
Zoe Washington Sheff is a fashion editor and creative consultant for leading fashion magazines and the founder of Little Bird, a fashion consulting company focusing on the teen market. We've got more information about Zoe and Little Bird on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's all for us today. Nathan Sterner is Maryland Morning's co-host, director, and engineer. Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, and Kathleen Cahill produce the broadcast with assistance from Scott Seiss. Our interns are Brooke Savage and Lauren Ferguson. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville provides us coffee. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote our theme music. Coming up Monday morning, a conversation with Dr. Robert Franklin on imagining justice from the Christian perspective. Plus, a controversial scholar on the role of Islam. We'll see you Monday morning right here on Maryland Morning. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.
Hoped you would in time. And I know that when you're holding me, it's her that's on your mind. And I know you can't get over her, but I love you nonetheless. But it makes no difference what I do.